From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, state attorneys plan criminal charges for former Governor Rick Snyder and others for the Flint water crisis.
They were not happy with the investigation that had taken into this case for several years, and this is the first indication that they're actually planning on moving forward with prosecutions.
Then, the effort to vaccinate Michigan's teachers with hopes for a face-to-face restart. Also, Betsy DeVos's track record as education secretary and school choice advocate.
Academically speaking, during this period of growth of charter schools and growth of school choice, we saw Detroit schools become the worst performing school district in the nation.
Plus, some fresh thinking about the places we shop and meet during lockdown.
You know, how are businesses going to welcome patrons? How are they going to get through the winter if they can't have people inside their spaces in the ways they're normally accustomed to?
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Published reports tell us that charges are on the way for former Governor Rick Snyder and others implicated in the Flint water crisis.
Their sources are telling them that the former governor, Rick Snyder, and others may be facing charges soon related to the Flint water crisis.
We'll have more on that for you later in the show. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has announced that K-12 school teachers are among the groups who can now get COVID-19 vaccines. She also said last week that she wants all schools to offer at least some in-person classes by March 1st.
The value of in-person learning for our kids is immeasurable, and we must do everything we can to help our kids get the great education they need and to do so safely.
Many educators say that they're very eager to get back to the classroom, as long as they can get vaccinated first. But how quickly will that happen? Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick has been talking to a number of teachers, and she joins us now. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, April.
Can you remind us of the big picture here? When did teachers start getting vaccinated in Michigan?
Well, really just kind of within the past few days. Governor Whitmer last week made the big announcement that the state was expanding who's eligible for vaccinations and opening it up to phase 1B, which includes, quote, essential frontline workers, which includes K-12 school teachers. But what it also happens to include is people 65 and over, which obviously that's a demographic that's been hit the hardest by COVID. It makes sense in a lot of ways. But some teachers are kind of, I don't want to say upset about it, but they wonder kind of why they weren't included in their own category, because they see it as it's sort of setting up this sort of cutthroat competition to get vaccinated. This is Elizabeth Willoughby. She's a teacher in the Lakeview Public Schools, which is in St. Clair Shores, and she's been trying to get to book a vaccine at Detroit's TCF Center.
But they threw the teachers in with this huge demographic of 65 plus. So we are literally fighting for vaccines with a huge demographic.
So a couple of teachers expressed that sentiment to me, that there's sort of been a separate, at least mini rollout for teachers, and that there should have been better communication with local health departments about how they were going to administer vaccines for teachers.
Sarah, you talked to a number of teachers about their experiences with all of this so far. It's, what can we say? It's been quite the year. What did they have to say?
I mean, the experiences range pretty widely, right? Like I talked to probably I'd say about a half dozen teachers, and obviously I can't speak for teachers in general, and no one teacher can, but it really seemed to be a huge range. I talked to one teacher who teaches at a private school in Oakland County. They said their school has a COVID coordinator and that they've actually been in class in person, but that everything in terms of the vaccine rollout was communicated. It was very smooth, and you know, this teacher got an appointment pretty quickly through Oakland County to get vaccinated. But I talked to another teacher from a charter school who said basically they received no communication whatsoever from their school about how to get vaccinated at all. All they really got was sort of a note that, well, if you do get vaccinated, please let us know so we can keep track. But no real information, no guidance about how to go about getting vaccinated.
Mm. So where should teachers look if they want to get the vaccine and want to start reaching out?
So that's a really good question. So back at the press conference last week, Governor Whitmer told people to teachers, you know, ask your employer about getting vaccinated. And from what I'm hearing, school districts were like, what are you talking about? No one communicated to us that this was coming. And beyond sort of helping get our teachers get hooked up with whatever the local county or, you know, local health infrastructure is to get vaccinated, we don't have any sort of special access to vaccines, and we're not, you know, we're not in a position to actually administer vaccines to our employees. Now, there may be some exceptions to that, which I'll discuss in a little bit, but Karen Leonard is one of the teachers I talked to. She teaches in the Troy Public Schools, and she actually did get her first shot this week through Oakland County. She's a pretty high risk. She has type 1 diabetes and a lung condition. But she says basically how they all found out about it was that teachers teamed up to get info out to each other about how to sign up and get appointments. But she just kind of happened luck of the draw to get in. And she says lots of her colleagues just can't get appointments at this point.
I can tell you that many teachers are very fired up and upset about how this was rolled out because, you know, we're all tired. We're all worn down. We're all tired. We're all doing the best we can, but it's a lot.
And she says she thinks there should have been better communication between the health department and school districts. I mean, presumably they know how many teachers they have and, you know, could set aside a certain number of doses. But actually in Oakland County, it seems like folks are having better luck, at least, you know, maybe getting appointments. In Wayne County, for example, outside of Detroit, and Macomb County, as far as I know, I don't even know that they're really vaccinating teachers. They're referring, at least in Wayne County, all people 65 and over to local health systems, and that doesn't seem to include teachers in that category. So in some places, it appears at least that teachers don't, you know, have much or any options of actually going about getting vaccinated right now.
Sarah, it seems like some school districts, maybe the very large ones, or I guess maybe extremely small ones, might actually have the logistical firepower to administer vaccines to teachers themselves. Have you heard about any districts that might try to do that?
So the only district that I'm aware of so far that plans on doing that is the Detroit Public Schools Community District, which is the largest school district in the state. I inquired with them yesterday, and they said they're working out the details with the city health department to directly provide vaccines to our employees and also contracted workers like bus drivers and maintenance staff, and that they hope to start that next week. But I talked with a DPSCD teacher named Vicki Green. She's a high school teacher. And she said all the communication she had received from the district so far didn't indicate that. She didn't know about that. They said basically if you want to get vaccinated, teachers can get vaccinated right now, but the district didn't really provide any additional information. Now, Green lives in Detroit, so she's trying to book an appointment at the TCF drive-through vaccination site, which just opened this week, but she hasn't had luck so far. She's teaching virtually right now, but she really wants to get the vaccine before she goes back in the classroom.
So Governor Whitmer says she wants to get schools back in person as much as possible as soon as March 1st. And I distinctly felt a mix of feelings in the public reaction to that. I mean, a mad sense of elation among parents and some educators who've been really frustrated with staying at home, but also, shall we say, a certain skepticism given how everything's been going during the lockdowns so far. What do you think the odds are that we can expect a vaccination of a critical mass of teachers to make that possible?
Well, I have to say, I have to emphasize that all of the educators I've spoken to or heard from are really eager to get back to the classroom. They really want to go back to class. they don't like this current situation of hybrid or virtual schooling as much as the rest of us don't like it. But again, most that I talked to said they themselves and their colleagues really want to get vaccinated before they go back. And this is Vicki Green again, the Detroit Public Schools teacher.
And it's like, well, if you really, really want that to happen, then we need to figure out how to give teachers priority to get the vaccine before we make that happen.
So in terms of your question, obviously, I can't really say, and no one can really say, whether we're going to be able to get two doses of the vaccine into a huge number of teachers by March 1st. Obviously, we've got time constraints. There are continuing vaccine supply constraints. I mean, at this point, it really does kind of seem like a long shot. I really have to say that in terms this issue that the teachers kept bringing up in terms of being lumped in with the 65 plus demographic, that is sort of maybe going to make things difficult. And county health departments either don't have enough vaccines yet, or they don't have the infrastructure to administer the vaccines yet. We did get the announcement yesterday from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that they're going to release more vaccines, that they'd been holding back as second doses. Presumably that should ease up the supply constraints, but then it's sort of begs the question of, well, do we know for sure whether people who got their first doses will be able to get their second? So like a lot of things right now, it's sort of a complicated and uncertain picture.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned that there was this big announcement from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services this week, responding to Governor Whitmer's request to release several hundred thousand vaccines that it's been holding back. It looks like Michigan's going to be able to buy them direct. Can you say a little bit more about how much that might move the needle in terms of getting teachers access to the vaccines?
I think it will certainly help ease up the immediate supply constraints we have, where we have, you know, county leaders and others being, you know, even health systems like Michigan Medicine saying, well, we're ready to vaccinate folks. We're ready to vaccinate X number of people within Y amount of time, but we simply don't have the vaccine supplies available right now. So presumably that will help with that. I think the question that it brings up, and I think this is especially relevant when it comes to teachers, you know, having this apparent goal of returning to classrooms by the start of March, is whether we can get the two doses that are required into everyone, you know, within that relatively short amount of time. So while the HHS announcement will presumably allow more people to get vaccinated, I mean, it's all sort of trickles down to the local level in terms of how they decide to administer that and whether they're going to hold back for second doses or whether they're just going to try and vaccinate as many people as possible and just sort of hope the supply keeps on flowing. So yes, it probably will help, but whether we can get that critical mass of teachers by March 1st is, you know, who knows?
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, thank you so much.
Of course, you're welcome.
In just a moment, we're going to look at the influence and legacy of one of Michigan's most prominent advocates in education circles, and that's Betsy DeVos, who has just stepped down as Secretary of Education.
Academically speaking, during this period of growth of charter schools and growth of school choice, we saw Detroit schools become the worst performing school district in the nation on the nation's report card.
That story is coming up in just a minute. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The resignation of Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education marks the end of an era. Conservative causes like school choice had an advocate in Washington like no other, with her leading the Department of Ed. We wanted to unpack DeVos's time in the Capitol and think about how much of her agenda might outlive the Trump era. Today we're talking with two people who followed DeVos's career closely over the years in Michigan and beyond. Let's start out with Chastity Pratt. She is the Wall Street Journal's Education Bureau Chief based in Detroit, and she's been reporting on education from here for a long time. Chastity, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Can you take us all the way back to when Betsy DeVos first showed up in the education world? I mean, she did not have a background as an educator herself.
No, she did not. A lot of Betsy DeVos's involvement with education came through her advocacy for charter schools and school choice. I'll take you back even further to the early 2000s, or maybe even 2000, when there was that ballot measure in Michigan about vouchers. You know, the DeVos family was really involved in pushing for vouchers in Michigan some 20 years ago. That voucher ballot proposal failed, but from there, you know, their involvement, her involvement in school choice and charter school advocacy increased. Some would even say that the charter school landscape that we have in Michigan, and certainly which is the majority of schools in Detroit, was because Betsy DeVos and her husband, their family, really put a lot of money behind pushing for increased charter school, just across the state. And so now we have a majority of the children in Detroit attending charter schools, and I think it's the second or third largest charter district in the nation, largely because DeVos lobbied for it and put money behind politicians who would curry favor for charter schools and state policy.
There is no question the effect that she's had on education in Detroit. What kind of influence do you see her exerting on education more broadly in Michigan? How much change was she able to affect?
The charter school and school choice lobby was hugely impactful in Michigan, right? So there were laws that expanded school choice. And what I mean by school choice is people being able to go to, you know, different school districts or to charter schools. And, you know, I remember back in the day when I was at the Detroit Free Press, we did what had to be 8 years ago now, a huge charter school project that basically laid out how charter schools became dominant in Detroit, in Flint, in other areas that are largely urban across Michigan. And what that really showed is that the charter schools, I mean, we're 20 some years into charter schools in Michigan, and yet and still it's only been in the past few years that they could say definitively that charter schools are maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 points ahead of public schools. It took 2 decades to gain very small achievement gains for charter schools to be able to say they're better than public schools. And even now it's very marginal at best. And then the other thing is, you know, the impact being when you spread charter schools the way Michigan has without very much accountability, with this free market mentality. A lot of the charter schools in Michigan, very much different from other states, are management company charter schools, for-profit companies running these charter schools. So it was a total flip-flop in how public education had been meted out in the state, now having these for-profit charter schools that don't have as much accountability as charter schools in other states, now really educating a large percentage of students, definitely in Detroit and across the state. You have, what, 300 charter schools? You got
that sounds right.
More than 100, yeah. More than 100,000. Like, so now we're looking at 10% of the kids in the state in charter schools, if not more at this point. It's hugely impactful.
What can we say about the tools that Betsy DeVos used? You mentioned the power of her purse in funding ballot campaigns. Were there other methods that she was able to use effectively to make the changes that she wanted to do?
Money is king. You know, when you get a Republican legislators, when you give money to them on the basis that they will support school choice and charter schools, that is hugely impactful. So that was really the big tool. You know, you want to be a Republican legislator in this state, we'll give you lots of money, but you have to do the work of school choice and charter schools. So that really led to the impact, and I think put her at the forefront to become the U.S. Education Secretary because of the impact that their money had.
You know, you touched on this a little bit, but can we say that the changes that she advocated for helped kids in Detroit get into better schools? What kind of things are you looking at when we assess the claims that competition will improve education options?
Well, you got to start with whether that was really the point, right? So you would have the charter school advocates saying that parents are in schools that don't work. They deserve a choice. They deserve options. And a lot of parents who were really disgusted with their charter, with their, you know, traditional public schools, were willing to give charter schools a chance. But what got really confused in the whole process was whether or not the charter school movement was offering a choice or a better choice. Parents interpreted that to mean that these were going to be better choices. And for more than 2 decades, charter schools were not better choices. They were really on par with traditional public schools for the better part of 2 decades.
You know, her situation, her profile was pretty high. The Secretary of Education is not usually a household name. That certainly was not the case for Betsy DeVos. I can't remember any other secretaries of education who were parodied on Saturday Night Live. We had Kate McKinnon playing the education secretary. Why do you think she became such a controversial figure beyond the world of education?
I mean, you know, remember back to 2018 when she was on with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes. It was a hugely controversial interview because Leslie Stahl asked her simplest questions and she couldn't answer them. She couldn't even cite Michigan performance status, academic achievement stats. You know, she couldn't say how well or how badly Michigan students were performing, yet she had been involved in schools in Michigan for years and years and years. So, and then there was that instance where there was the debate around guns in schools, and she made a comment about teachers should have guns in case there's a bear attack. I mean, there were these little gaffes along the way that, you know, people clung to and said, well, who's this person? Why is she the U.S. Education Secretary? But to be sure, she has a huge following among conservatives, right? Because her whole tact was to come into the Department of Education to temper the government's involvement in schools. Her sort of mission or her mantra was that government has never made anything cheaper or better, and that's really apparent in schools. So we need to pull back government involvement in schools and let the local school districts decide everything. That was hugely popular with conservatives. Fiscal conservatives. And so, you know, she had a lot of support from her side of the aisle, but on the other side of the aisle, a very vocal side of the aisle, teachers unions and school districts where charter schools were pervasive and not doing well were saying she was destroying schools.
What's on your mind about how she ended her time in Washington?
She was the longest standing cabinet member and one of the first to leave the cabinet after the mob stormed the Capitol. So, you know, whatever you think of Betsy DeVos, whether you think that she did some harm when it came to Title IX or, you know, student loan protections, or whether you think that she was the best thing since, you know, conservatism for the Department of Ed, she did stand up last week and say, I'm out of here. I can't stand behind what is going on with this administration in terms of, you know, the mob that attacked the Capitol.
Chastity Pratt is Education Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, coming to us from her home in Detroit. Chastity, thank you.
Anytime.
Here to talk us through Betsy DeVos's impact at the helm of the Department of Education, as well as what her legacy might look like, is John Vallant. He's a senior fellow in the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution. John, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Thanks for having me.
So what have Betsy DeVos's top priorities and biggest impacts been? I mean, through the whole range of K-12 and higher education during the past 4 years, what do you think of as her signature work?
So I think from the get-go, her top priority has been getting Americans to think differently about public schools and the role of private providers in public education. So she pushed very hard, really from before she was even in office, to advocate for alternatives to traditional public schooling, for private school vouchers and for charter schools. And she didn't get very far. She certainly didn't get very far when it comes to legislation on those issues. She probably had more influence through her advocacy work before she became secretary, actually, than she did as secretary. But that persisted as kind of a primary focus in K-12. I would say the other big priority related to deregulation and pulling back the federal role in education. And a lot of that had to do with pulling back civil rights protections that the federal government had been providing to students. So a primary function of the federal government in education is to protect student civil rights. And through a number of different ways, she and her administration really did pull back when it comes to protecting transgender students or victims of sexual assault and sexual harassment and students of color who have been subject to harsh discipline. And so really, I would say that her priorities have been deregulation and providing alternatives to the traditional public school system.
What does this mean for regulations that she passed that the Biden administration might like to see reexamined? Do you think that it will be possible if the incoming secretary chooses to alter some changes that she made?
Yeah, it's a good question. And so if you want to have a lasting impact as an education secretary, really what you need to do is get legislation done through Congress. And we had very little legislation in education over the last 4 years. So there won't be that lasting impact through legislation. The sort of second best approach as far as having lasting impact is through regulation, through a formal rulemaking process, where you sort of interpret how existing legislation will be implemented. And she really didn't do much even in terms of regulation, with the exception of regulation on Title IX. So we now have the federal government's position on Title IX, which really looks over how accusations of sexual assault and sexual harassment are handled, looks quite different. That will be difficult for the Biden administration to undo, or at least to undo quickly. I think they certainly are going to try, but that went through a more formal rulemaking process that now would have to be undone. Then there's a sort of next tier of action that a Secretary of Education can take, which is what we call sub-regulatory guidance. And often it's letters that sort of suggest what the government's position is on an issue and make recommendations to school districts. And there's been a dance kind of back and forth from the Obama administration to the Trump administration and now to the Biden administration, where you would have one administration put forth some guidance. So the Obama administration, for example, put forth guidance about how schools should handle student discipline so as not to discriminate towards students of color. The DeVos administration threw away that guidance, which they can do just with a stroke of a pen. But when it comes to that type of guidance, the Biden administration will sort of undo what the DeVos administration and the Trump administration just did. So it varies sort of depending on how the work was done. But I would say that the actual list of legislative accomplishments and even lasting regulations is pretty thin.
During her time in office, Betsy DeVos got a lot of criticism for reducing protections for students' civil rights. Can you talk a little bit about what you noticed about the rights that she prioritized and those that she didn't?
Sure. So it's useful to take a second and think about what the federal government does in education, because education is primarily the function of local and state governments. The federal government's role exists in large part to protect the most vulnerable students. So the federal government puts about 10% of the money into our education system. And when it puts money in, it's disproportionately going to students in poverty and to students with disabilities. And as sort of part of that broader obligation, it protects student civil rights. So it is responsible for making sure that students aren't discriminated against on the basis of their sex or their race and sort of on from there. And the Democratic and Republican administrations have taken very different postures toward that. So what the Obama administration believed was that it had an obligation to look for systemic issues in addition to investigating individual cases of accused discrimination and civil rights violations. So it was on the lookout, for example, for whether there were certain districts where students of color were discriminated against when it comes to how they were disciplined, or and they were concerned about transgender students' rights and bathroom use and issues along those lines. The position of the DeVos administration was very different in that they were not nearly as willing to focus on systemic issues when it comes to civil rights, and thought that their obligations were much more on just investigating individual cases as they came up. And so they pulled back on their protections for transgender students and really lots of other groups. And that extended to higher education too, when it came to protections for students who had been defrauded by for-profit colleges. And so so in my own view, it will be a welcome change when I think the Biden administration will start to think again about the federal government's role in looking after systemic issues in addition to just those individual cases. But it's really a very different philosophy about how we approach civil rights.
If you could sum up her legacy from her time as education secretary in a sentence, what would you say?
Well, I'll try a word. I think politicization. So what Betsy DeVos will be remembered for more than anything else is that she took issues that either had been fairly bipartisan in the past or didn't necessarily have to be politically charged, and she charged them. And so I'll give you a couple of examples of this. One was charter schools. And for a long time, they'd enjoyed some support from both the Republican and Democratic parties. So the Clinton administration and the Obama administration had both supported charter schools. And Betsy DeVos, by being such a polarizing figure and being paired with President Trump, who obviously is just as polarizing, she charged that issue and caused divisions between Republicans and Democrats. And she would say that I think that part of her legacy that she wants is that she changed the conversation. I think that she did change the conversation in the sense that she charged an issue, and we now have much less room for bipartisan agreement than we did before.
John Vallant is a senior fellow at the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution. John, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, April.
Up next, how some businesses are redesigning their workspaces to be outside in a time of COVID. We'll also check in with the Michigan Radio Newsroom about criminal charges expected against former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder in the Flint water case. More in a moment. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced the state's indoor dining ban is going to continue at least through February 1st. She added that the state's Department of Health and Human Services would allow some indoor exercise classes to resume soon. With the holidays now over, Michigan's businesses are facing long, cold, dire weeks of winter. So many of the shops and restaurants we love have already been lost to the pandemic. Is there any way to improve the chances of those that remain? The folks at Design Corps Detroit have been thinking about ways to help retail and restaurant operations. These were outlined in a recent video post. Design Corps' Executive Director Olga Stella joins us now to talk about them. Olga, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me, April.
What does design thinking have to offer us at a time like this?
Well, design thinking is primarily about problem solving, and we've got some big problems to try to solve, especially if you're a small business owner trying to figure out how to make it in our winter conditions.
I saw this Onion headline the other day that read, "Michigan restaurant server asks frozen bodies of dining couple on outdoor patio if they'd like to see dessert menu."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's right.
I mean, it's grim, but at the same time, I think it really speaks to the stakes for businesses right now and our communities, right?
Right. And it isn't as simple as always putting up, you know, one of the igloos, which is definitely a possibility. But we are in a pandemic. It's not just about physically being outside. It's about being outside in a safe way with the proper airflow and all of that. It's a lot on business owners to try to think through. And part of our message is there are architects and interior designers and others who can really help you think that through, you know, consult with you and just help you try to come up with something. We know that many of these small business owners, especially in Detroit, they are cash strapped right now. They can barely figure out how to make it happen. So what are some of the solutions? How can they, in an inexpensive way, try to keep slush, you know, away from the doors of their business or create some wind protection? There are a number of ways that you can do this. It just requires a little bit of creativity, and sometimes it might require a little bit of outside help.
Is there a starting point for thinking about user experience in this way?
You know, part of what we've been encouraging is for business owners to really think about what is the main thing that they are trying to solve for. Do they need a better way of accommodating their guests while they're queuing to come inside their store or doing carryout pickup or something like that? Are they trying to create an outdoor space for dining where people could, you know, stay in the space and eat their meal? Is it marketing? Are they trying to do is solve for a visibility problem and create more visibility for their business on their street? if they can really identify what's the key thing they're trying to solve for, and then start to think about winter conditions and things that would make it difficult for them, you know, whether it's slush or precipitation, wind, you know, those kinds of things, the need for heat, then you can start to make some priorities around, well, how am I going to solve for this? Am I going to build a simple raised platform in my parking space in front of my business? Am I going to take part of my parking lot and create a little bit of a windbreak and create a little bit of an outdoor room just using some basic, you know, materials? Am I going to try to do something to the exterior of my building that just clearly delineates this is a protected kind of waiting space, if you want to comment, and just start to break the problem down into its component parts and start to figure out what those solutions are.
The video outlines some interesting options for heat. Can you run us through some ways to warm up the outdoor environment that might not cost an arm and a leg?
I mean, I know a lot of people are looking at propane heaters and electric heaters, and those do have constraints. You know, the propane itself can be expensive. If you don't have outdoor electricity, that can also be challenging. But one of the best examples, it's a really, really fun example, and it looked like you could do it for under $150, is this modified version of a Katatsu table, which essentially is a table with a small, thin electric heater on the bottom of the table that you can easily attach, and then a blanket that goes over the table. And in Japan, in Hokkaido, Japan, these are in regular use. And your lower body is really heated up sitting underneath the blanket by that electric heater. You can be relatively comfortable outside.
Yeah, I know people will know what I'm talking about if I say they're the tables that food gets cooked on at Benihana or places like that.
You know, I haven't been to Benihana in a while, so I'm not sure if they use the blanket piece of it, but that blanket, and you can interchange that blanket out. You know, you get a bunch of flannel blankets, not too expensive, and just change them out in between your customers.
You also borrowed an interesting idea from a design contest in Chicago, and that's the wind protection that we can get from a potted tree formation. I mean, how many trees do you need to have a tangible effect?
Well, I think it depends on how big your space is, right? In the video, you know, we show examples. It was a company called Stantec in their Boston office. They created a gigantic tree barrier in a big parking lot as an example. But if you're a small storefront and you're just trying to create a little bit of protection, I mean, it might just be, you know, one or two evergreens. If you already have planters out front, just thinking about kind of those small evergreen bushes that can just create a little bit more height. You know, one of the fun things that the Stantec office in Boston came up with for this dining competition was the idea of using snow. If you're already moving snow around in your parking lot, can you build up that snow so it creates some of that wind protection? Be a little bit more intentional about it. You know, this is where designers are really helpful because they can look at space and help arrange space in a way that then executes these ideas. And that is a skill that requires, you know, some training. You may have some natural skill at it, but this is why people go to school, right? To go to design school, is to be experts in this. And so there are lots of designers in our community who can offer that kind of advice and help a small business owner, you know, think through what is the simplest, easiest way for me to create this wind protection, create some of these just visual amenities also that will help more people see my business and want to use my business more this winter.
Olga, you mentioned the igloos that we've seen popping up, especially at some restaurant and bar locations. They look kind of like miniature Buckminster Fuller balls with plastic webbing over the top. I wanted to just ask you what you think of them. I mean, if we can put aside the possible health benefits or detractions in something like that, just what you think of them. I can't help when I pass by them but thinking they kind of exclude us from the kind of experience that I think a lot of people want when they go out.
Yeah, it's not, maybe not always an ideal choice, but I think we're also recognizing everybody's doing the best that they can. In the research that we did, one of the things that we're seeing is you can also, and again, I want to be really clear about kind of accessibility and the ability of small business owners to execute some of these ideas. You know, a better option might be to, you know, to build a simple, like, three-sided structure, just like with a leaning roof. And, you know, there's some examples of that in the presentation as well. But it does require actually, you know, going and getting the wood and having someone who has some carpentry skills who can help you figure out how to design and build that. If you don't have that and you're trying to figure out how you're going to at least have some social interaction for some of your patrons at your business, the igloo, or there's a number of other kind of plastic tents that you can get, that might just be the best option. It's not necessarily, I think, ideal from air circulation perspective. So definitely want to caution about, you know, what the health implications are. And you're right, it creates a sense of an exclusive space for a small number of patrons, which isn't what is usually happening inside a restaurant or a bar. But I think we all kind of recognize all these business owners are going to have different means by which they can execute solutions. And so some of them are going to be somewhat imperfect. You know, we're not going to be able to get all of our goals necessarily.
Are there businesses that you're missing that have closed up?
Oh, you know, I mean, I could probably go through some restaurants and worry about some restaurants that have temporarily closed. But, you know, we've been trying to stay in good touch with our friends and patronize them and gave a lot of gift certificates this winter for a variety of the small businesses in the city. So it's hard to start to go through a list of names, but I know it's really appreciate the struggle that our small businesses all throughout the region are going through right now and trying to keep those doors open. Just really appreciate what these business owners are doing, because they bring vitality to our communities.
Are there places you know of that have been able to hold on because of innovations that they've made in their physical environment or the way that they do business?
Yeah, two good examples. One is Folk, which is one of the winners of our Commerce Design Refresh grant this summer. They've really just worked on changing up their business model to focus more on carry out and kind of walk up. You know, you see that with Mudgee's in Corktown as well. You know, they've really embraced the outdoors and figured out that outdoor space and completely transitioned to an online ordering system and to more of that commissary. A number of the restaurants that have kind of figured out how to work commissary operations in, and I think are holding on.
Olga, what do we mean by commissary type operations?
So it's more like a grocery. So you're going in and you're buying your olive oils and, you know, baking products and other kinds of things. Sister Pie is doing the same thing. So in addition to buying, you know, the finished, you know, pies and cakes and goods, you can basically order a list of groceries from them as well.
Right.
And so a number of places are doing that. The businesses that have really thought about what their added value is beyond just what they traditionally did are the ones that are finding some other ways to bring money in. There's a ton of really fun marketing stuff that's happening too. And I think the Peacock Room and Frida and Yama, that trio of businesses all owned by Rachel Lutz, really exemplifies like just the way that Rachel's been using social media and online sales and the idea of like a Facebook sales party. You know, we haven't talked about events and ways to bring people together, but that is also something business owners can start to think about, is how can they give people a reason to want to come to their business this winter, even if it is cold outside. You know, these outdoor improvements, if you think of it almost like I'm creating an outdoor extension of my business space, but then how do I activate that? Well, maybe through some special events that, of course, you know, are done in a safe, socially distant way, but just a reason for people to come.
Where should people go if they're looking for help with these issues?
Design Corps does have a member network of design businesses that are throughout the region, and we are very happy to help make connections to business owners who are looking for designers who can help them, not just with their physical problems with their business, but also with, you know, all the other kinds of design help, digital and marketing and so on.
Olga Stella is the Executive Director of Design Corps Detroit. Olga, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Former Governor Rick Snyder, his health director, and other ex-officials from Michigan's government have been told that they are being charged after a new investigation of the Flint water scandal. Two people with knowledge of the charging plans spoke to the Associated Press about the matter this week. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody has been following the story as well, and he joins us now. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
It sounds like very few people are talking on the record at this point. What do we know so far about who's getting charged and maybe the nature of those charges?
At this point, all we know is what the Associated Press has been reporting so far, that their sources are telling them that, as you said, the former governor, Rick Snyder, and others may be facing charges soon related to the Flint water crisis. And beyond that, we're not hearing a whole lot. The attorneys for Mr. Snyder and a couple of other people have commented, basically, you know, taking the sides of their defendants, obviously, and saying, you know, at this point that this is more of a smear than a charge. But we may find out soon what the actual charges may be involving these potential defendants.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like criminal charges against state officials would represent a significant shift in how the state has handled the case to this point. Do you have any sense of why this is happening now?
Well, that's a very good question. Originally, there were 15 state and local officials who were criminally charged in this case. About half of them pled guilty to lesser charges, didn't serve any jail time. But when the new attorney general came in, Dana Nessel looked at it, assigned her solicitor general to oversee the investigation, and it was determined that they were not happy with the investigation that had taken into this case for several years, and they decided to dismiss the charges against the remaining defendants and have ever since not said anything about what they were doing. And this is the first indication that they're actually planning on moving forward with prosecutions. So the timing now is a very good question. I spoke with Peter Hammer. He's with Wayne State University. He's a law professor. He's also the director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights. And he said he's very interested in the timing of these charges himself.
The whole criminal effort to be charging people has been its own train wreck. I mean, so the people in Flint had to first deal with the train wreck of the public health crisis, and then a train wreck of failed efforts, and then a withdrawal of the charges. You know, so I'm going to be very interested in trying to listen to why are charges now being brought against a set of defendants that are very, very high up in government that were not brought before. And I really think it's going to be the nature of the cover-up being the crime.
Steve, can you bring us up to speed on whether and if this might have any effect on civil litigation around Flint?
Well, the civil litigation and the criminal litigation have been on two separate tracks almost since the beginning. In fact, in the Attorney General's office, there's essentially a firewall between the part of the AG's office that's been working on the civil side and the part of the AG's office that's been working on the criminal side, both prosecuting and also providing defense for members of state government. So these have been two very different tracks that these different streams have been on. But they are kind of converging a little this week because we're also expecting a decision this week by a U.S. District Court judge as to whether to give preliminary approval to a massive legal settlement to settle many of the hundreds or thousands of lawsuits that have been filed in relation to the Flint water crisis.
Peter Hammer mentioned it, but there are still thousands of people in Flint who are living with the day-to-day realities of this. Have you heard anything from folks in Flint who were affected by the poor quality of water about whether a prosecution, that level of accountability, is something that they were still looking forward to or hopeful would happen?
I would not say hopeful. Many people in Flint have become completely disenchanted with the idea that state government will ever do anything to make up for what happened to their community and punish those who were responsible for it. When the cases were dismissed against the defendants about 2 years ago, there was a big uproar in the community that no one was going to be punished. The idea that there may be people prosecuted again, it's more of a wait-and-see attitude, though there are people who, now that they see that the governor is potentially on that list, have a little more hope that they will get the justice they've been seeking.
Any comment from former Governor Snyder or anybody else who might be facing charges?
Nothing from the specific defendants, because after all, they haven't been charged with anything yet anyway. We're still waiting to find out what and if they will be charged with. Their attorneys have weighed in on this. The governor's attorney basically said any charges against his client would be meritless. We'll see what they'll have to say if and when we actually see any charges filed.
Michigan Radio, Steve Carmody. Steve, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our interns are Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow.